Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Hi, I'm Roberto Mazza, and this is Jerusalem Unplugged, your gateway into the multi-layer narratives of this iconic city. Each episode, I'll guide you through Jerusalem's mesmerizing chronicles and present-day realities. With leading experts as guests, we'll examine the city's intricate past, raging social-political debates, and nuances of its cosmopolitan culture. Let this podcast be your immersive audio expedition, allowing you to experience the dynamic voices that define Jerusalem's powerful mystique. Join me on this thought-provoking journey into one of the world's most fascinating places that has captivated everybody for centuries. Welcome to the first episode of our series exploring the current war on Gaza. In today's episode, we'll be taking an in-depth look at the current situation within Israel itself, examining the state of Israeli society and the complex political dynamics at play. And in order to do that, my guest is Gilad Alper. Gilad Alper is a journalist and the co-founder of a Tel Aviv Review podcast, which I urge all of the listeners to tune in and listen to their amazing interviews. But more importantly, Gilad is a good friend and has already been a guest of the podcast. Israel remains a deeply divided nation with sharp social and ideological rifts running through its population, from secular versus religious divides to the long-standing left, whatever the left may be, right political schisms. Israeli society is characterized by a plurality of viewpoints and identities. On the political front, Israel's government is currently led by one of the most right-wing coalitions in the country's history. Igniting concerns over the trajectory of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, minority rights, and preservation of democratic norms. We will analyze and discuss the key players, policy positions, and controversies surrounding the current administration. As we navigate this complex landscape, it's important to remember that this is just one part of a larger, multifaceted issue. So in our coming episodes, we'll turn our focus to Palestinian society from the voices and perspective of those living under Israeli occupation. We'll also examine the stances and roles of a so-called international community of nations in relation to this conflict. But for now, let's dive into analyzing the currents running through Israeli society and politics at this pivotal moment in history. Gilad, this is our second conversation. We had our first one right after the elections. Obviously, we couldn't have known that things could have changed so much in the past year or so. But before we start talking about Israel, 7 months into the war, Gilad, welcome.
Thank you, Roberto. It's nice to be back.
So I really want to start asking with these basic questions. This podcast will be aired on May 7th, even though we are recording, just to, you know, give the listeners the right date and understand that things may change between now and then. Today is May 3rd. And I was wondering if you can give us a sense of how is Israel 7 months into the war? How does the country look like, you know, now?
Well, 7 months into the war, it's more or less the same as it was 6 months into the war and 5 months into the war and 4 months into the war. It was palpable earlier in the war that we're not going anywhere, and that there's this stalemate and a bit of mudslinging between Netanyahu supporters and opponents, and also the pro-Israel crowd in the world and the pro-Palestinian crowd in the world, blaming each other for the stalemate alongside many other crimes, rightfully so. But the thing is that it's really unprecedented in the sense that this is the most protracted war Israel has ever fought, and against, I would say, probably militarily at least, the weakest opponent ever.
Let me ask something about the current politics of Israel. I mean, obviously, if one just navigates Twitter, shall we call it X, one may think that there's a lot of blaming for, you know, Bibi Netanyahu's and maybe his government. But my feeling is that there is a trend to just pin everything on him and the few of his associates. Whereas I believe that this may be problematic because it's always hard to pin everything on one single or a few individuals. And I was wondering if you can give us a sense of it. How exactly is Israeli politics moving nowadays? I mean, what's going on with the majority? Who is the minority? And who are these people that maybe have an official role in Israeli politics, but we may not hear because they're not present or necessarily as present on social media as, you know, Bibi, Ben-Gvir, and Smotrich?
Well, the media plays obviously a crucial role here in amplifying some voices as opposed to others. Quite an experienced journalist and a journalism scholar myself, and I tend to not overestimate the power of the media in creating a discourse. I think the media amplifies a discourse, but it doesn't create it. I think that Netanyahu has pinned himself as the main protagonist in the Israel story, not just the Hamas-Israel war story, but in the Israel story of the last 30 years, if not more. There was this, I mean, this is not news to anyone, I'm guessing, that there has been this ongoing cult of personality on behalf of his cronies and he himself, of painting him as this historic figure that's really unparalleled and irreplaceable. And that has also trickled to the camp of his opponents. They are called in Hebrew, Rak lo Bibi, anything but Bibi. They are sort of the never Trumpers of America. And the thing is that if you look at it, it's also a big part of what is considered today the center-left in Israel, because Yair Lapid and Benny Gantz and all the centrist parties and some of the Labour Party and Meretz as well, I'm guessing this is really a big chunk of the opposition to Netanyahu, are never Trumpers in the sense that they were more or less supportive of his policies, but very much negative on his personality and demeanor. And this sort of politics, first of all, enabled Netanyahu to become the longest serving prime minister in Israel's history, because, you know, if he is irreplaceable in the eyes of his own camp, as well as to an extent in the eyes of his opponents, so why replace him? I mean, this is, it creates, you know, this electoral dynamic that works, has worked in his favor so wonderfully. But also, if you look at it now with the benefit of hindsight, after the 7th of October, it also created the conditions for this crisis of the 7th of October, because they were, I mean, more or less, I'd say close to 80% of the Israeli political landscape were more or less in favor of his policy that led to the 7th of October, that was strengthening Hamas, dividing the Palestinians between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, that is, between Gaza, the Gaza government, and the West Bank government, and thinking that Israel could go on prospering without solving the Palestinian issue. And a tiny minority on the left, and on the right, on the radical right too, admittedly, said that it cannot last much longer. I mean, the different camps that warned against it on the left and on the right, of course, presented very different solutions to that problem, but they did point the finger to the problem. And I tend not to be one of the never Trumpers, or, you know, anyone who assigns or attributes too much responsibility to one person. I mean, clearly it's a historical, and this is not something that, you know, an intellectual or a scholar should do, you know, attributing the weight of history to the actions of one person. But I think that Netanyahu, in this sense, played an enormous role in leading us to where we are. From the beginning of his political career, I'm talking about the 90s, if not the 80s as well, his entire life's work was bent on undermining the Palestinian national cause while selling us Israelis and the rest of the world this notion that the Palestinian national cause is mutually exclusive with the Israeli one, therefore it should be done away with at any cost. Whereas in reality, people like myself, and I still believe that before and after the 7th of October, that the only thing that could guarantee Israeli security and Israeli prosperity and longevity is a solution to the Palestinian issue. And Netanyahu has been incredibly dexterous at undermining any political competition to that idea, from the Oslo years and Rabin and Peres to later Sharon, even though his attempt at finding a solution, Sharon's attempt at finding a solution proved rather futile, and Olmert as well. I mean, every single one of his political opponents who were trying to put an end to the or try to put an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict ended up being washed away by his incredible political skills. So it's really, I think a lot of it is really down to him. And once he is removed, and I still think that this day is closer than we imagine.
And it's really what I wanted to ask, because sometimes in conversations I had over Passover week here in Israel with my extended family, a conversation that reminded me, you know, what the Americans normally call the crazy uncle around the Thanksgiving table. So certainly there were opinions ranging from the far left to the far right. But one thing I understood is that many were arguing, well, once he's gone, everything will be different. So my question is that, will it be? will that his departure really change the political landscape? Because again, my view is that when I look at individuals like Benny Gantz, Yair Lapid, who might be the successors, they may have a different attitude, but the policies are not that different.
Yeah. No, because I think it's all a result of the Israeli privilege was instrumental in creating, and I'll explain. This Israeli privilege let Israel have its cake and eat it too. So as I said, it can be this prosperous country, the economy was doing very well, it had great ties with the rest of the world, whether diplomatic, commercial, academic, cultural, what have you. People from around the world, including the Arab world, were clamoring to have relations with Israel and be closer to Israel. And Netanyahu, for his own reasons, and also with a certain degree of justice, claimed credit for it, that much of it was his doing as prime minister for so long. And all this, his argument was that, see, it can be done also without catering to the Arab issue or the Palestinian issue. So, because previously, and this is what, the Oslo paradigm was really set on, that Israel can only prosper economically and politically and diplomatically if it moves forward on the Palestinian track. And back in the 90s, it was true, because up until the 1990s, when Israel changed its attitude towards the Palestinian, it had been this backwater country, completely isolated from the region. And, you know, it was this so-called vassal state of the United States, completely dependent on it. I mean, now we see to what extent this dependence goes on. But of course, now and in the last few decades, Israel was much less dependent on foreign support than it used to be. So there was this link made between sort of a progressive attitude, progressive regional attitude, and Israel's global interests. And Netanyahu came and changed it. And for a long time, he proved that it was true. And then people said, okay, he created this notion that when negotiating with the Palestinians, Israel was doing them a favor instead of pursuing its own national interests. So this brings me back to your question. Right now, I think we are still cruising on this outlook. People are still thinking in the same way, even though the 7th of October dealt a tremendous blow to that note. It proved that the Palestinians are not going away, and that that keeping them at bay doesn't really solve anything in the long term. But it has brought Israel closer to a T-junction. You know, it's basically a dilemma that it would have to address sooner rather than later. And that is whether to continue opposing a two-state solution or whatever solution there is to the Palestinian issue, or taking care of its own interests. That these two options would be increasingly mutually exclusive. Now, I think that in Netanyahu's case, it's pretty clear. And it's anyone who's been following his demeanor during the last 7 months realizes that, because he had plenty of opportunities to try and minimize the adverse effects of the war, bring back the hostages, and strive towards a peaceful, you know, an ending, sort of a ceasefire, and an ending to this war. And he refused. And I think that on the Palestinian issue, he remains adamantly adamantly opposed to any sort of solution to the Palestinian issue, even at the expense of Israel itself. And I think the others, and you know, looking at it historically, there's ample evidence to support that. I think that the others, be it Benny Gantz or even Yair Lapid, and even some people from Likud itself, you know, Av Gallant, and maybe others, when the moment of truth comes, they will have to choose between either preferring their, you know, dogmatic ideology, or doing whatever is best for the country, and that is moving towards a peaceful resolution of the some conciliatory solution with the Palestinians. And up until Netanyahu, and this is again my very personal account that I have with him, is that Begin was at this very moment vis-a-vis Egypt in 1977, 78, 79. Ariel Sharon did the same in the beginning of the 2000s, and he chose to go ahead with the disengagement. And the same with Olmert and Livni, who were actively pursuing a two-state solution when they were in government briefly. Now, none of these four people were less ideologically right-wing than Netanyahu himself. But when, as I said, the moment of truth came, and they realized that this is really the best thing for Israel, they went with it. Now, Netanyahu is cut from a different cloth. And I think part of it has to do with his political survival instincts, that he will do virtually anything to remain in power. I mean, the others were realizing that, you know, it is a democracy, and they could, by making this leap forward, they might lose their supporters and lose political power, but they did what's right as leaders. I don't think he has that in him, certainly not now. I don't think he ever had it in him, but that's a different issue. And also, I think he's much more ideologically solid than they were. I mean, I'm not saying it as a compliment to him. I think that people who update their view of the world according to the changing circumstances is really what makes good leaders. But he's, as I said in the beginning to your answer, in the beginning of my answer to your question, his life work, 100%, was undermining the Palestinian national cause. And I don't think that that's going to change. The others, Gantz and whoever, I think are more of the other kind of right-wing leaders who will do the right thing only when they have to.
And, you know, you just mentioned that, and that reminded me when Bibi Netanyahu, when the by the name as Ben Nitai, so there is this famous interview available on YouTube, I think it was with ABC already in 1978, when he, I think he was working for the foreign office of, you know, as a diplomat. In his interview, basically he said exactly that, you know, there's no room for a Palestinian state. The argument was slightly different from today. He didn't even call them Palestinians, really. He was using the word Arabs, which was very, you know, the narrative of the day. But essentially, what I notice is that in his political life, there's been this kind of a consistency in denying the possibility for a Palestinian state, given whatever circumstances. So that was true in the 78, in the 90s, and then in the 2000s. So you're right. In that sense, you can see that he is not the kind of leader eager to make concessions or to be, you know, ready for the moment. And as you mentioned, Begin, I, as an historian teaching that to students, I always remember the face of Begin shaking hands with Sadat. That was, you know, the face of someone who didn't want to be there, but he understood that he had to be there. I mean,
the same with Rabin and Arafat. I mean, I didn't mention Rabin, even though he is of the same kind. I mean, he was a leftist, so-called. So it was trying to make, but it's certainly the same. I mean, and even Rabin himself, for years upon years, opposed the idea of a Palestinian state. So when you're talking about that interview or that discussion that was in 1978 with Netanyahu's participation, that is available on YouTube, and it's very interesting to watch. Yeah, I mean, Netanyahu then represented the consensus in Israel, not just on the right. Even though he came from this revisionist pedigree, right? His father was this well-known revisionist historian and was Jabotinsky's secretary. But it only shows, actually, it's, you know, for us historians, it's really interesting to see to what extent the Overton window in Israel has shifted with respect to the Palestinians. As you said, they didn't even call them Palestinians then.
I want to ask something about the other components of the current Israeli government, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. I'm personally fascinated and very much interested in messianic movements, particularly Christian Zionism. You know, obviously, this is a movement that developed in America. It has obviously a Christian connotation, connected deeply with Israel and Judaism for their own reasons. And despite Ben-Gvir and Smotrich do represent different religious ideas, but there are certain trends and common thoughts, you know, shared between these two movements. And I always feel like people may not fully understand exactly who they represent, as in general in Western media, they're just presented as messianic, or sometimes I think even with dismissive terms as crazy. And I think this is also part of the fact that for a long time, even before the elections that brought them to the government, they were considered fringes. And so people did not pay much attention to the fact that actually they were gaining consensus. And I've seen that even with members of my own family. You know, they gained that kind of consensus from religious conservatives that saw them as an alternative, as a new, you know, form of acceptable politics. So I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about them as individuals, but also the politics that they represent.
Yeah. Well, I am not a big expert on messianic movements. I'm just an observer of the politics of it. And to my mind, politically at least, there's very little difference between, it's like, you know, 50 shades of messianic fascism, if you will. It's really, essentially, it's the same thing. And not by that, I don't mean just the fact that they pursue the same politics, but also that this politics comes from more or less the same place. And that is not a very ideological place. I don't think there are, even in America or wherever, you can always find religious justifications for the most horrible ideas ever. I don't think the theological weight of the worldview is anything that would outlast them in any considerable way. What they do well is, just like, you know, right-wing agitators everywhere in the world, whether it's in Europe or America or where have you, is really whip up the most basic negative sentiments that average voters have. Now, I think as a leftist and as someone who sees politics, I wouldn't say as a noble endeavor, but something that is really has the potential of improving us as a society, I think that what leaders have to do is not pander to these very basic prejudices, but actually combat them and say, okay, we are better than, a bit like parents, right? You know, telling the children when they misbehave, you are better than this. You know, you can punish them, but you can, I mean, I think a better educational way is to say you are better than this. And I think that this is what politicians should do with the people. Now, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are doing just the opposite, because what they are, I think that the power base of the popularity is really this very basic, it's just hate. They are politicians of hate. And this hate is, first of all, not new. I'm talking about hate of Arabs, of course, among Israeli Jews. It didn't start with the emergence, with the coming of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich on the scene. It was there long before that. I mean, anyone in Israel, I don't know, my coming of age was in the late 80s and early 90s, but I'm guessing it was even before that. You could hear chants, death to Arabs, after any kind of terrorist attack. It exemplary progressive democracy. So this is really what they do very well. They channel this hate and translate it into political power. And I agree with you, having said all this, I agree with you that they have gained a great degree of legitimacy. And that is not so much, again, I mean, coming back to our previous question, I think also much of that is thanks to Netanyahu. Because he saw in them very loyal political partners. And he knew that their loyalty was ironclad. And therefore, he tried to give them to make them as powerful, as electorally powerful as possible, so that they would bolster his own government, his own majority. Now, I'm not particularly very concerned about the long-term destruction that Smotrich and Ben-Gvir might wreak for Israeli society. That is, I'm sure that they're doing a lot of bad things. Many, many bad things are done in their name in Gaza at the moment, and also in the West Bank. But I don't think it's really a long-term irreversible trend for the Israeli society, because here too, the only reason that they are really powerful is because they have Netanyahu's Likud to rely on and give them basically whatever they want in government. I mean, they are blackmailing him unabashedly. And I think that once Netanyahu is gone, they would be also much less powerful than they are, because they'll be far or removed from positions of power. Now, I don't know. I don't interact with many Ben-Gvir supporters. I don't really understand the logic. I do interact with some Likud supporters and some Netanyahu supporters, and I think there is this dissonance in them between the rhetoric because they think that what Ben-Gvir, right, solution, and that is to kill everyone, more or less. And the realization that they all have, or many of them have, that these people were in government when the 7th of October happened. So, I mean, if they really had the solution to every problem, how come the 7th of October happened and happened in this way? I mean, it's not just in negligence that led to that on the 7th of October in and on the in during the run-up to it, but also the horrendous response that came thereafter. And I think very few people deny that, but it's a bit like, you know, it's sort of, you know, going back to theology, it's sort of like a theological dilemma here. It's a bit like Haredim in the aftermath of the Holocaust said to themselves, if God exists and he loves the Jewish people and is a generous God, how did he allow us to undergo this the greatest horror in human history? And I think that some Ben-Gvir and Smotrich supporters are giving the same sort of answer that the Haredim gave in the aftermath of the Holocaust, saying, okay, we didn't do enough. I mean, we were very extreme already, but we weren't extreme enough. So I think that they are going to pursue that with greater thrust, but at the same time, just like the Haredim post-Holocaust, they are still a minority, and they are a minority that's currently very, very powerful because of this political constellation in which they work and exploit so well. But once Netanyahu is removed, and I think that more Netanyahu supporters are disillusioned about his policies and his personality than Smotrich and Ben-Gvir supporters are about theirs. So once he's removed, they will have very little power left.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And I want to challenge you on this point because, again, this is a part of an observation about the demographic structure of Israel. I mean, when we look at the changes that are occurring in this society, one cannot but obviously note the fact that the religious component of Israel is growing exponentially, and obviously it's becoming a larger community than, let's call it, the secular one. And I remember reading some papers written by demographers. Actually, one of them was the famous Sergio della Pergola, who already wrote that by 2050, one of the major issues that Israel could have confronted was not the demography of the Arabs, but actually the demography of the religious population in Israel. And I was wondering if you feel that there is a tension, you know, between the secular and the religious society over this question of demography and who may eventually become, you know, sort of the bigger group in Israeli society.
Well, this is a good question. And I think that the, well, I have a few things to say about all these demographic predictions. First of all, we've been hearing these gloom and doom predictions about demography for as far as I can remember. Yeah, that by 2020, every second first grade student would be Haredi and what? Sure, they are growing exponentially. They are much more, not just in terms of numbers, but also in terms of political influence. They are much more powerful than they used to be, and that's down to a political decision on the part of the leaders of aligning themselves strictly with the right wing and Netanyahu, also for their expedient short-term interests that might backfire, and I'll get to that in a second. But also, the other thing is that not just the Haredi sector, but also much of the national religious sector, the religious Zionist sector, represented by Smotrich and others, I would consider the settlements, but all, not just the settlements themselves in the West Bank, but all the surrounding apparatus that supports it, whether it's like educational institutions and other NGOs that are. Basically, what I'm saying is that these two, the religious sectors, are incredibly dependent on the state and on the state budget. And the state budget, of course, is created from our taxes and taxes of working Israelis who are disproportionately secular. So the situation is, and has always been, that the hardworking secular Israelis are basically bankrolling the religious sectors of society. People have always, seculars that is, have always been unhappy about it, but they sort of lived with it because they said, okay, this is Israel, this is what we signed up for. And also because now, previously, especially the Haredi, but also all the religious politicians weren't as brazen as they are today in pursuing power and their very narrow interests. So that created a backlash that we've seen, and that was part of the undercurrents of the wave of protests that we saw in 2023 up until the 7th of October. That the realizing for good reason that the religious, the Haredi and the religious Zionists are absolutely complicit in the attempts to undermine Israel's liberal democracy for their own reasons, of course. For the religious Zionists, it was to gain full control of the West Bank. Because the one thing that stopped them was this semblance of, you know, a legal system of occupation in the West Bank, as opposed to full annexation and the creation of, you know, the enactment of Israeli sovereignty over Greater Israel. And for the Haredim, it was because the Supreme Court and all the other legal arrangements prevented them from pursuing their own autonomous way of life. One aspect of which, and perhaps the most obvious one, most conspicuous one, was their exemption from military service. So the Haredim also were very happy to undermine the rule of law in Israel, because this principle of equality is what prevented them from getting permanent and full exemption from military service. So once the Supreme Court was gone, they could do whatever they want in that respect. So this brought tensions around that to a boiling point. I mean, there were so many other things that were in the air at that moment around the so-called judicial reform. But this was certainly one thing that many secular Israelis care about. And it has not gone away. If anything, it's only amplified since the 7th of October, because we saw this great mobilization of Israelis, mainly secular Israelis, to go to reserve duty and to fight in the war, and also this great civilian mobilization led by several organizations, most notably Achim Lanashek, Brothers in Arms, who are this group of volunteers whose common point, right? The common ethos is their military service. And at the same time, while thousands of Israeli soldiers were fighting in Gaza, the Haredi politicians, again, with very little shame, worked towards consolidating the Haredi draft exemption, all sorts of budgetary decisions benefiting yeshivas and what happened. I mean, basically further entrenching their dependence on state budgets. Now, I think that politically it was a very bad and stupid and short-sighted decision that would probably backfire, a bit like the if you take America as an example, the overturn of Roe v. Wade, that was really the realization of many conservative dreams, but in fact politically it might serve them well. It did serve them. It might serve them further. Badly, because it created this liberal backlash, and I'm guessing that a similar thing might happen in Israel among Israeli seculars. But also, again, coming back to making a decision in getting to this T-junction, Netanyahu can write a blank check to the Haredim, because Israel now has money. But when it runs out of money, or has less money once 40% of its population would not be economically productive, what do you do then? Do you continue to support this 40% on the backs of the 60% until the numbers flip and the productive people become 40% and the unproductive people become 60%, and then the Israeli economy would not be able to sustain itself? I think Netanyahu would say yes, because it benefits him politically. And as I said before, one of his ultimate goals is to cling on to power for as long as he can. But I think that any responsible leader would realize that it's not sustainable in the long run, and then would have to do something, reach some sort of arrangement. Now, I think that the Haredim, at least, have prove that they can be pragmatic if they want. Now they have no incentive to be pragmatic because basically Netanyahu is giving them whatever they want. But once they would have to choose whether to get some of what they want or not at all, I think they'd be ready to cut a deal.
I have a couple of more questions, and one is very much based on Israel, and the other one is about your recent trip to America, and so also asking about your views of how Israel is perceived from abroad. But about Israel here, I want to ask about, let's call it the peace camp. I mean, my impression being in Israel is that there's not much appetite to talk about what may be the future after the war will end. And I also understand that, you know, there are many different views, obviously representing, you know, political views before October 7, but also representing feelings that have changed as a result of October 7. So I was wondering if you can tell us if there's any, you know, movements, organizations, people, individuals that are actually already working about what might be, you know, a future of cooperation, dialogue. I mean, it's hard to find the right words in this situation, in this context. But obviously, I think we all learn that you cannot push the Palestinian under the rugs. I mean, that's obviously what October 7 did, really, is to bring them back into the main, you know, framework of a discussion. Maybe not with the right means, obviously, we can agree on that. But it shows that you can't push them under the rugs, certainly no longer.
No, I certainly agree with that. And in that sense, despite all the horrors that we've seen since the 7th of October, I think that, you know, looking at it dispassionately somewhat, we are at a much better place now than we were 2 years ago, because this realization is much more commonplace than it used to be. Like, as I said, the dream Netanyahu sold us that Israel can be prosperous without addressing the Palestinian issue has been shattered. Now, about cooperation and dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians, there are still some groups trying to do that and do it admirably. There's actually next week, there's the Memorial Day, and the Bereaved Families Forum are organizing the annual memorial service for victims of the conflict, both Israelis and Palestinians. And I just saw an advertisement. It's going to go ahead as planned, as every year. And this is just one example. I think that it's valuable, and I've taken part in dialogue programs many times over many years as a teenager and as an adult. But I think that one of the things that failed the Oslo process was that it was trying to put the cart before the horses, in the sense that it was working on dialogue and winning hearts and minds among average Israelis and Palestinians, instead, before taking care of or securing a political solution. They were working under the assumption that once Israelis and Palestinians get along better, there would be some sort of like trickle-up phenomenon, you know, pressure applied on leaders to strike a deal. And that was a misconception. Now, I think that the one thing that might greatly help that trend of reconciliation would be a renewed peace process, but in earnest. And I think that in this sense, we are closer to that, because you politically, I mean, even people who are really reluctant about it are saying that there's no other way but to give powers to the Palestinian Authority. in Gaza and in general. I mean, strengthening the status of the Palestinian Authority also internationally. And working towards a two-state solution, you hear that from the White House, you hear that from Europe. For the 7th of October, it was little more than lip service. Now, I think it still is the way it looks now, but lip service. But I think that they realize that it's more urgent than they had thought. And also, if you look at Saudi Arabia, before the 7th of October, they were perfectly happy to strike a deal with Israel and sweeping the Palestinians under the rug, and that is no longer the case. Now, I don't know. We hear all shreds of information. We don't know the full picture, but it seems that it's a much more central issue today than it was before the 7th of October. So I think that this slowly emerging consensus that is an alternative to what Netanyahu has been trying to pursue and is still trying to pursue now, I mean, by refusing to consider any involvement of the Palestinian Authority in any planning of the day after the war in Gaza. But this is something that, you know, even people in his own government, Yoav Gallant, has been saying, people in the army have been saying, let alone people in the opposition or, you know, people who are Netanyahu's opponents, whether Benny Gantz or Gadi Eisenkot. There is this consensus forming that the Palestinian Authority is the answer. Now, I think that if they pursue it in earnest, there is a great chance that it might trickle down to better relations between Israelis and Palestinians, also on the ground. I think that NGOs cannot work independently from the broader political landscape, that decision makers and NGOs cross-fertilize each other. And right now, I mean, it has been for some time now, the NGOs have had to work on their own. And that's why they've been I wouldn't say meaningless, but their impact hasn't been as great as you might expect. And that is, of course, cause for despair. And I admire these people for getting up in the morning and still pursuing in doing that, despite the fact that the reality goes in the other direction. It looks bleaker and bleaker each day. But once the broader tides turn, I think there's also potential for growth there.
So when I watch American media and I consume, whether it's on televisions or on social media in general, I am often shocked by the images of Gaza. And despite, I can say quite frankly, that American media in general are biased towards Israel, with some exceptions. But if anything else, they are actually showing images of the war and the damages of the war and the suffering of the people. Something that you don't see often, I would say probably never, on Israeli media. You were in the States for a couple of weeks, if I remember well, following your tour. And I was wondering if you can tell us, what was your experience of, you know, moving from this different kind of setting as a journalist, you know, how the war is portrayed in Israel and, let's say, the West, but just using the example of the United States?
Well, you're asking about the media specifically, or also like the discourse and the way the media, I mean, I consume the international media when I'm in Israel as well, and I see the great difference. And people have been saying for a long time that if Israelis saw what other people, I mean, non-Israelis, see in the media about Gaza, they would have a totally different view of what's going on. Now, first of all, I don't necessarily agree with that, because if there's one thing that we know about people is that denial is one of the greatest, most powerful survival instincts. People don't want to see what they don't want to see. And I think that's true. And I actually recently watched The Zone of Interest, that movie that won the Oscars, and the acceptance speech of the British Jewish director made a lot of noise because it was it specifically called out the Israeli operation in Gaza. Now, the Zone of Interest is really about the family of the commander of, I think it's Auschwitz, or one of the great death camps in the Nazi death camps. And it's like this bourgeois, middle-class German family living in this lovely villa, just and sharing a wall with a death camp. And they hear the shots and the screams, and they see the smoke coming out of the crematorium, and they're just living their bourgeois life, you know, with a beautiful garden and piano lessons and what have you. So, I mean, we learned that lesson about denial. Not that I'm comparing the extent of the horror, of course, but it's we learned that denial is not something to be underestimated. Now, as my own experiences as an Israeli and an Israeli journalist, I never, unlike many other Israelis, I never lie about my origins. When people ask me where I'm from, I say it without hesitation. And I have to say that it's not just now. I've lived abroad for many years. I've traveled. I don't think that I ever encountered a negative reaction, at least an explicit one. Some people were unfriendly, but that's maybe because they were British. I'm joking. I think that what's really driving many people in their reaction to the crisis in Israel and Palestine is this feeling of shock and horror and helplessness. And this takes many forms. For many people, it was just be saying this, it's really horrible what's happening there, and I hope that it comes to a swift resolution sooner rather than later. Some people that know my politics feel more at liberty saying that they criticize Israel for what it's been doing, and some of them are asking very intelligent questions because they just want to know. And I think that what we're seeing is on campuses right now, but also actually I was there in the States just before the encampments were set up. I left a few days before. So I didn't see it with my own eyes, but I saw like the tensions brewing towards that. And I think it's just this feeling of helplessness that people are experiencing, that, and of course there are young students who are filled with passion and think they are going to change the world. We've all been there. And I think that what we're seeing now is basically people who are channeling their frustration at the open-endedness of this war that doesn't seem to be going anywhere, that this stalemate that people realize is serving the bad guys here, that is Netanyahu and Yahya Sinwar, and also the fact that they are complicit in it, because as American taxpayers, they see that what enables all this was, first of all, American arms shipments, but also this diplomatic umbrella that the White House has been providing. And even before the war started, these people, I'm saying generally, it's not people who were great Israel lovers even before the 7th of October. But I think they, after the 7th of October, they simply cannot cope with the extent of the misery and the destruction that was done implicitly in their name. So it's just saying, we desist. We will not take it any longer. And it leads to some extreme measures. Some of them are very childish ones, because they are students after all. But I think this is really what's fueling people's reaction, is this mixture of horror and helplessness.
I want to just ask one last question, and, you know, we could stay here and talk about Israel and Israeli politics in times of war for hours. But I was wondering, and pick your brain, if there's anything that, you know, maybe because I'm led by my own ideas and ask questions following those ideas, if there's anything that I didn't ask, but you feel it's very important for listeners to understand about Israel, May 2024, 7 months into the war.
It might sound a bit trite, I'm guessing. But I think that there is really quite a lot of reason for hope. I was speaking actually while I was in America to the co-host of my podcast, Yael Bada. And we sort of agreed that Israel now is like France in the 1930s. It could go either way. It could go down the fascist route, and it could be saved. Now, we all know where France headed eventually, but it wasn't at all sure until rather late in the game. I mean, and Britain faced a similar fate, but was saved from it. No, in Britain it was slightly. I mean, the fascist currents were a lot less powerful than they were in France, but still. And things can turn out very badly for Israel and the region, as they didn't have done already. I mean, it's not. This is not a walk in the park. But there can be. We can pull the brakes. It's not too late.
This was Gilad Halpert, Israeli journalist, broadcaster, media historian, and co-founder of the Tel Aviv Review of Books. And I always tell the listeners, please do listen to the podcast of the Tel Aviv Review because they're informing and fascinating. Gilad, thank you.
Thank you, Roberto.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others on social media or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Jerusalem Unplugged. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.